Hello, everyone. Welcome to Indie Radio Broadcast number 26. With us today, we have our co-host Ian, and then Alec Haloka and Zoe Quinn for our interview. Indie Radio is an indie game development talk show, which is here to bring you interviews with both large and lesser-known developers, recap the latest news, debate about topics in indie gaming, and to give you some tips and tricks for your journey into programming. I'm your host, Brett Hudson, broadcasting live from the Midwest United States.
I'm the co-host, Ian, and I'm broadcasting from the Eastern Coast of the U.S.
And, yeah.
Hi.
Hey. I'm Alec Haloka. I'm an indie game developer from Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. I made a game called Aquaria. I worked on a bunch of other stuff. Winnetron arcade project and other things that I forget because I'm sleepy. And I'm with Zoe Quinn.
I'm also... Wow. Can't talk.
Yeah.
I'm off to a good start. I'm also an indie game developer. I've made a bunch of smaller stuff. I'm working on a project with Alec, and I started a nonprofit called Dames Making Games, which helps women who are interested in making games learn how to start doing that, and supports the ones who are already there, and people who support us too.
So that's who's with us today, and we're going to get onto the news right after this. Cue music that's not loading. That works. All right. Come on. My computer's been god-awful slow today, and I don't know why, but, the music kind of took a few seconds to get there. So first off, we're going to talk about the Stencil news. There's a few things going on with Stencil. First off, they introduced Stencil Pro and Stencil Studio. There's some upgraded packages that allow you to compile for Flash, Windows, Mac, iOS Pro, Android, and HTML5. Looks like there's some new features, and it's also splash screen free, so you don't get the stencil flash screen or splash screen. Can't talk today. And then, if you want to look at some more features that they have in it, you can go to the blog.stencil.com and check it out there.
Blog.stencil.com. Yeah, check it out, kids. I've never used it, actually, but Zoe's used it, I think.
Oh, I used it shortly. It was actually what I was trying to make my first game in, but I kept hitting a bug repeatedly when I tried to put too many dialogue tree-type things into it that made it overwrite the class files with blank XML files, so I kind of just went and learned Flash instead. But I hear it's getting better,
mm-hmm.
I hope. But it has a pretty good interface for people who don't know anything about coding, like, to get used to just basic how things flow.
Yeah, I really like the way that they have that puzzle piece kind of thing, where you just snap bits of code together, which it seems like a really cool way to teach people programming. It's a shame that the program seems to have a bunch of bugs and stuff, though,
mm-hmm.
At least just as far as I've seen, like, yeah.
It's like Lego code.
Broken Lego.
On April 20th, which was last Friday, I believe, if I can get my calendar right in my head, Stencil 2.0 arrived, and they have a little summary of what's new. They have pictures, so I'm just going to have to read the titles, but there's some new event stuff, easy block picking, trash can, pre-ship behaviors, and then they talked about what's next, which leads us to the next bit of news. 6 days later, which was this past Thursday, they released Stencil 2.1, yep. You want to take that in?
Oh, I'd hate to, but I'm going to anyways. So Stencil 2.1 is basically improving the scene designer to make it...
make it worse.
Don't you just love, you know, cutting off halfway through saying something? Anyways, so, let's see. It's apparently relatively bug-free now. And they're adding a bunch of new functionality to improve your productivity while making scenes and everything. And that really, I don't think that's much else other than the scene designer that's going to be updated in Stencil 2.1. But, I mean, still, that's great and all. It's mm-hmm. just, don't use Stencil, so it's kind of hard to say much about this stuff.
Yeah. At the bottom, it says that they'll be releasing Stencil 2.1 in May, meaning that it's not quite out yet. And then at the end, it says something about how they're working on Stencil 2.5. So I have no idea what happened to 2.2 through 4.
Four versions there. Okay.
Yeah. And then it says, which will introduce support for Android and HTML5. All right. And over at the GMC, Game Maker Community, they're having the GMC Jam number 6. And this is obviously their 6th jam. It started Saturday the 28th of April. And is going through Monday. So it's a 72-hour competition with the theme of tranquility. There is a handicap restriction that says you must include one or more achievements to unlock within your game, separate from the main goal or objective. And they have, you know, the common rules that they have. There are some official prizes, such as a banner. And then additional prizes. A bunch of people are giving prizes, which sums up to a $420 value. So, definitely worth checking out if you use Game Maker. Ian, you can shake the next one.
The Wild Game Challenge. So, there's a game... There's a game development competition that's going to be held at the end of every month now, apparently. It's a 48-hour solo competition, similar to the Ludum Dare, I guess. Or Ludum Dare, as you're supposed to say. And you can go check out the link if I think we can put it on IndieBurst.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see.
Not too much is out, other than, there's one going on right now, which is why we're talking about it. And, it's led by InfoRat, and then he just wanted to start a competition, so he started it. And the rules are, if you enter the challenge, you must work solo. All code and content must be made within the assigned 48-hour period. Failure to do so will result in disqualification. The game has to be based upon the community-selected theme. All libraries are used in this competition must be made by you, or are open source, and then you must provide a link as to where the library framework, etc. was found. Source must be included in the final release. So it's pretty similar to Ludum Dare. I don't see much of a difference, other than obviously it's hosted by InfoRat and is a bit smaller. And they have an IRC. It's on the same network that ours is, afternet.org. It's just, the channel is Wild Game Challenge. So hopefully you can spell. Next up, the PlayStation Suite SDK is now in open beta, and it's available to anyone. So if you want to develop for the PlayStation Vita, or the PS3, I believe, you can get the SDK, which will allow you to publish to the PlayStation Store. And then, skimming through this, it says the open beta version includes a 2D graphics engine and a 2D physical engine with content samples to demonstrate these features. The full program, due to be released later this year, will allow developers to sell content through the PlayStation Store on a commercial basis and will cost $99 annually.
The Fez soundtrack is out now, and apparently people have been discovering lots of secrets hidden within it. For example, there's one where someone ran it through a music visualizer program and an odd image appeared, and as well as others in which they found specific dates and numbers and things. So if you want to go check that out, that was on the Indie Games weblog, and you can go see it for... That was last Friday, actually, two mm-hmm. Fridays ago. But, yeah. You probably want to find this stuff out on your own, so I really don't think it's that big a deal if you want to go just check out and see what everyone else has discovered so far.
The album has 26 tracks and it's priced at $7. You can download them as FLAC files or high bitrate MP3s. And then it says, read on at your own risk, though to be honest, the stuff that you're very unlikely to discover on your own if you want to read the official post on indiegames.com. Next up is the Humble Botanicula Bundle debut. It's another Humble Bundle, basically, with a really ridiculously long name. And this one... Botanicula.
I think that's how you're supposed to pronounce it. I'm not really sure here.
Mm-hmm. This bundle, the basic design for the website, is a little different. Instead of having the platform where all the games sit on, there is a branch. And it has the main game, which is that really confusing title, Machinarium, Samaras 2, Cookie, and then the bonus game, which you have to pay more than $8.84, which is the highest average I've seen yet, Windowsill. And then they have a new thing where you can donate to the World Land Trust, and they've preserved 1,220 acres so far. There's 5 days, 5 hours, 18 minutes, and 16 seconds left. And currently there's only been 77,488 bundles sold. There's another bundle going on right now, the Indie Gala 4. There's 17 days left in this, with 7,463 bundles sold so far. So they're definitely not doing as well as the Humble Bundle, which... comparative would be 10%. They have a few games: Iris, Extinction Agenda, Alien Shooter, Disciples 2, Galleon's Return, Altitude, and then two bonus games that haven't been announced yet, and a giant question mark. So it seems like they're going to be putting out more games as time goes on, which is rather interesting.
And then we have another bundle.
Which just ended a little while
The Indie
ago.
Royale has released the Spring Bundle, and that includes 6 games. Unstoppable Gorg, I'm not even sure if that's how you're supposed to pronounce it, honestly. But then The Depths of Peril, Toe's Vertical Adventure, Inferno Plus, Slidris, these are really annoying names here, and Ballistic.
That bundle just ended, I believe, a day ago. And then, as always, they have like 20 bundles a month. So the next one is the May Hooray bundle, which comes in 2 weeks. The All Charity Lightning Pack, which is all question marks. It doesn't have a release date. But then the June Bug bundle is 5 weeks until served, so it's probably going to be 3 to 4 weeks, I'm guessing. I really don't see why all these bundles are... trying to push out as many games as they can, because all they're doing is giving us way too much. At first, you know, the Humble Bundles would be like once every few months, and you'd get all excited and you go buy it. But now there's new bundles every week, and, you know, people don't have unlimited money. So I think they might be overdoing it with all the bundles. So, Ian, I know you entered Ludum Dare. Did either of you guys, Alec or Zoe, enter it?
Me?
Zoe, sorry.
Zoe, yeah. Did we what?
Did you guys enter Ludum Dare?
Did you enter the Ludum Dare?
Oh, I was working on a jam, or no, was it a jam? I don't know. I guess it was kind of a jam game format.
Yeah.
I ended up making something called Gloom. And it's kind of like Proteus. I don't know if you played Proteus, but it's this indie game that's really like lo-fi pixel art in 3D. And it's just a very atmospheric game where you wander around. And I was kind of mashing it up with Sword and Sorcery a bit. And it was fun for a while, but I didn't end up finishing it enough to like submit it. So I just kind of didn't submit it. I got really far in like 1 hour. And then I was like, okay, I don't know what to do. Because basically to make the kind of game I wanted to make, it'd have to be like tons and tons of content and things you can explore and really subtle puzzles and stuff, and that would just take forever. Yeah, what were you doing at Ludum Dare?
Oh, I started prototyping something in Unity, but ended up getting distracted by the bigger project I'm working on now, which is, I don't know, I probably should have stuck with it, but I really wanted to work on my main project instead. Mm-hmm. So I made a really crappy, not really a game prototype that no one will ever see.
Yeah, unless like we steal it off your computer and upload it right now.
Over my dead body, Mister.
Stab.
Oh.
You heard it here first, folks.
So we jumped in the Ludum Dare chat the other day, the IRC, and we told people if they wanted us to talk about their game quick, that they should send Indie Radio a burst on Indie Burst, and Hedgemedge, and I can't remember the other person, let me check quick. Well, they both sent in their games, and we're going to talk about them quick. I don't believe you've played them, Ian, but I did quick. Oh, Fireblend's the other guy. All right, so Hedgemedge made a game called Nanobot Rescue Team, in which basically you're going through like this vein, I think, and you have to fight off germs using your little manned ship, and it's pretty fun. You use the directional keys to move and the mouse to shoot, and it's a lot like other shooters on the, or top-down shooters on computers, but I think the big thing in this one was the graphic style, because it was really interesting, and he did a nice job with particle effects and all that stuff. And then the other game would be Fireblend's DAH, he says. It is Disregard All Humans, and what you are is you're basically this giant monster on this world, and you have to destroy these towers by jumping on them, and every time that you jump on a tower, people run out, and when you eat people, the world gets smaller and smaller until it eventually just blows up. And it was a fun little mini game. I like the graphic style. It's just cartoony. And I like how the moon changes, the moon's like your health bar. It gets red as you start dying, and then yeah, so those are two Ludum Dare games that you can check out. We're going to be putting some links up on IndieBurst in a little bit if anyone wants to check them out. It's just on the Indie Radio page. And then other than that, we're almost done with our news. Ian wanted to bring up a topic on the Mozilla.org hacks website.
Well, okay, this isn't exactly news that's very recent or anything like that, really. But, well, the support's been getting a little better for it and whatnot, and it's supporting Chrome as well now. So in at least the latest builds of Firefox and Chrome, there is support for quite some useful things to kind of reinforce how powerful HTML5 is getting. So you have, what is it? First off, kind of the most minor one, which you've probably noticed if you use the HTML5 player on YouTube, you can now have full screen support where it completely maximizes the browser window and everything as though you hit F11 using JavaScript. You can also use the Mouse Lock API, which allows you to have real first-person shooter type games because the mouse will stay locked in place, which was a problem before if you were trying to do stuff like that. And finally, there's the Gamepad API, which allows you to use 360 controllers or things like that plugged into your computer and actually use the controller natively to play your HTML5 game. So all three of those kind of combine together to make HTML5 have some advantages over Flash, or rather compete with Flash at least. And you can just check those out if you Google the Mouse Lock API, Gamepad API, or Full Screen API will probably be one of the first results.
But yeah, it's crazy what they're doing. with HTML5, and it's definitely advancing a ton. Have either of you guys used HTML5? Oh, oops. Ha. I had Skype muted, I'm sorry. Have either of you guys used HTML5? Alec or Zoe?
What are you asking us?
Have either of you used HTML5?
Used HTML5 to make games? I haven't personally used it. I have a friend, Noel Berry, he built his own game engine in HTML5. And it seems kind of cool, but it also seems really annoying. I mean, I think one of the main problems is you have to use JavaScript, and JavaScript's kind of icky sometimes. There's lots of limitations, and you don't really get true object-oriented programming. You get kind of like weird hacky stuff. And so I don't know, but I mean, now that Unity can export to native clients, I guess in the future it's going to be more like you're using some tools to export to HTML5. You're not going to be writing HTML5 code. I guess something like Stencil or Unity. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Well, we're all done with our news, so we're going to jump on to the interview now.
Interview. Engage.
So, again, if somebody jumped in late to the show or didn't catch us the first time, we have Alec Haloka and Zoe Quinn with us today. Alec, if you could give a little recap of what you're known for, so people don't know you, know you.
Okay. So I was the co-designer, programmer, composer on a game called Aquaria. It won the Seamus McNally Grand Prize at the IGF Awards in 2007, I think. Something like that.
I'm not sure.
I don't know. Where are we right now?
I have no idea.
Okay. And I got onto Steam after that, and it was in the first Humble Indie Bundle. So it's been a really successful game. At the time, it was probably one of the most successful indie games. And then games like Braid and Super Meat Boy came along, and they're probably about 10 times more successful, at least like financially. And now Fez, like, I can't imagine how well Fez is doing. I forget how many sales they had, but it was a lot. As soon as it hits like PC and stuff, I mean, it's already insane. Though. I think they're already over like a million in terms of gross, you know.
A million?
That's insane.
Jeez.
And that was like a while ago, so.
Man, good for those guys. It's awesome.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. How long have you worked on that? It's like 4 years or something. I don't even know. I met Phil when he was actually at the IGF after we were winning stuff. And he was just kind of hanging around the IGF pavilion. It was kind of interesting, because he was just this, like, random dude, and I had no idea who he was. And then,
Then he made Fez,
the end. Shook him a day or something.
Yes, no, not even difficult, just boom, Fez, done.
And then,
yeah.
You go.
Your turn, Zoe.
Oh, okay. I have far less impressive. I am Zoe Quinn. I make weird little indie games. I'm working on a larger scale project with Alec right now. And I started a nonprofit called Dance Making Games, which helps get women who want to make games more involved and gives them skills and training and support and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I should mention also, like, I've worked on a few other things. I have a podcast called the Infinite Ammo Podcast. And basically, I just interview other game developers for like 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of good. It's kind of fun. I've worked on Winitron Arcade Project, which is a network of arcade machines. They all download and share games. And there's basically different people could build a Winitron machine for their own city. So there's Winitrons in New York and Australia and New Zealand and all of the states. But it started in Winnipeg. That's what's called the Winitron. But I don't think people realize that. I think they just think it's called the Winitron because of winning or something like that. But yeah. I've made a bunch of other games that nobody really cares about. The small things. Because I spent... Oh, that's nice. for example, I spent the last 4 years just trying to work on a larger project. I keep quitting and restarting. And I keep quitting it because I don't like it enough. It never turns out as the way I want it to, so I keep throwing it out. So it's hard. I think a lot of people, when they talk to me, they kind of assume that, like, once you have one reasonably successful game, it should be kind of easy at that point, and it's, like, not. If anything, it's harder. Because
mm-hmm.
people have expectations of, you know, what they think you're going to do and how good it's going to be and stuff. And I have expectations for myself that are higher than they were before, and so it's really hard to live up to those. And that involves just like, oh, well, this isn't good enough. Got to throw it out over and over again, which is kind of frustrating.
Yeah, I can see where you're coming from.
Yeah. I think a lot of people go through that. I think a lot of people go through the whole thing of like, oh, I really want to make this. I'm really excited about this. I think this is going to be great. And then you kind of build a prototype or something. And then you're like, ah, crap, it's not as good as I thought it was going to be. And then you have to sort of take it in a different direction and redo it. And the cycle goes on forever and ever.
There's also that trick that seems to happen with pretty much anybody who's in a creative position where you think, like a lot of people seem to think that no matter what they do, it's pretty much kind of crappy, and it's a real trap for creative people to fall into. Like, there's so many talented people I know that just hate everything they make.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to try to get that, try to balance your expectations of yourself and what your work is going to be with whether or not it's actually good or good enough.
You're going to have to, like, force yourself to finish stuff at some point.
Yeah.
Just the hard thing, like, even on Aquaria, I remember hating it right near the end of development, just being like, yeah, I know I need to finish this, and I kind of just, I don't feel like it's 110%, and it took a long time to get the ending to feel right, and it was like maybe a couple months, and all we had to really do was finish the ending of the game and a couple other details, and I just kind of sat on it for a while, because it was like, it doesn't feel right, and eventually we found something that I really liked and managed to finish it in a pretty good way, but sometimes you don't have that luxury. You don't have, like, if you're doing client work or if you have, like, a hard deadline, you don't have the luxury of waiting.
That makes sense.
Yeah, and I guess that's the kind of thing, like, I did, I think, one client job. I did a game called Incubattle. It was a beat-em-up with and Incubus in it. And it was fun to work on, but it was definitely different experience than doing something like Aquaria, where we had complete control over the release schedule, so we could just be like, oh, we're going to delay it, and then we're just going to keep delaying it until it's done. In the case of Incubus Battle, we had to deliver something, you know, within deadline, so we basically had to crunch really hard for like a week and a half right near the end and kind of force the game out. And it was an interesting experience to do that. It was kind of fun in a way, like a fun challenge, and it was exciting, and it made us work really hard, but then it also kind of meant that we had to rush through a couple things. And that always kind of feels a bit bad, so. And when you're working for yourself, it's really hard to just sort of be your own boss. You kind of have to force yourself to do that. You're like, I've got to meet this milestone, and it's like, but if I don't, the only person I'm letting down is myself. so you kind of have to beat yourself up a little bit to do that, which sucks. That's kind of the sucky thing about indie development like that, is you kind of have to, it's ultimately kind of a good thing, but you do have to kind of become your own boss and get really good at doing that.
Especially because, like, if you screw it up, you really have nobody to be upset had other than yourself.
Yeah, you don't get to pass the blame on to anyone else and be like, oh, well, this project would have been great if it wasn't for blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And it's like, no, it's all my own fault.
it's awesome and shitty and totally interesting ways, because it's just like, it's all on you and you have to just do it and either completely screw it up or get something out the door.
Mm-hmm. Right, Ian's got to leave, so see you, Ian. Thanks for being with us. So, Alec, I did want to say how big Aquaria is, because I was just talking with some of my friends from New Zealand, and one of them, I brought up your name, and they instantly recognize it from Aquaria, and apparently she's just this huge Aquaria fan. And then I've been talking to people, and they recognize your name and the game, and not a lot of people have recognized the names, like a lot of my personal friends. They don't recognize, like, Edmund McMillan or Chevy Ray. They don't know these people, but they knew you, so I thought that was kind of
cool. Weird.
They're like, oh, Aquaria guy. I'm like, yeah.
So, yeah, it's kind of weird how there are some indie developers who are well-known, but then they're sort of only well-known in certain circles, and it's kind of strange. Mm-hmm. Like, sometimes I meet people at GDC, and they're just like, they go into fanboy mode. And sometimes I meet people at GDC and they have no idea who I am. They're like, who are you? And they're almost kind of like derisive about me and stuff. And it's like, oh, it's just bizarre because I just want to talk to people like a normal person. So it's weird to get the different extremes. Especially when, like, one time I went to GDC and there's this older guy who worked on the Vampire series, Masquerade.
Vampire the Masquerade Bloodline?
Yeah, he was a writer on it, and he was just, like, the biggest Aquaria fan in the world.
Whoa.
And I think he was, like, 30 or 40, and he was just, it felt kind of neat, but it was also kind of bizarre, because it's just, like, you're older than me. you've probably done a lot more cool things than I have, because I haven't been around that long. But I don't know, it was neat, too. And I love fanboying out at people, too. Whenever I run into a developer... whose work I love, I just kind of think my way at them.
Mm-hmm.
It's fun to do.
Yeah.
Sorry, do you?
I try not to, because I feel like such a huge dork about it. I don't want to be like that person who's like making people uncomfortable, because I'm like, oh my god, you make law, I love law!
Most people like it, you know? Like,
I know, but yeah. It's like, I don't know, I'm a nerd, I get shy enough around people I admire, and just enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. I like doing it because it feels like giving something back to somebody who made something really cool. You know, it's just like just saying like, "Oh, I really love that. It really meant a lot to me."
That's why I send really awkward fan mail. Like, because in person, I'd probably just hide. But I'll be like, "Your stuff's awesome!" Oh my god, and feel a little bit less weird.
Yeah, when I started this show, we interviewed.
Oh, sorry.
We were interviewing people, and, you know, we got, like, Matt Thorson, and he was, like, one of my biggest idols back in the day, and I was all like, woohoo, you know, like, so, tell me everything, and, you know, I'd freak out and be all energetic and happy, and then over time I've kind of, okay, remember, you're on the radio, there's people listening, settle down.
Yeah, I had a lot of talk with a few other game developers, like Jade Raymond was there. We were doing this big talk at Toronto Independent Film Festival. One of the two guys who did a lot of the work on developing the Arduino was there. And, like, even though I was just done a talk here, I was still, like, hiding from him because I was like, oh, my God, I love your work. It's just, like, I don't know. You would think it would be less awkward in that context to just be like, oh, hey, cool, what's up? But I'm not.
I've often thought about, like, meeting certain people that I really admire their work and stuff, and sometimes I'm just like, I have no idea what I would say. I'm just going to be like, your stuff's so great. And then they'd be like, okay. And I'd be like, yep.
Yeah, exactly.
I almost don't think I could... I really want to share my experiences with their stuff with them, but I feel like they'd just be like, yeah, I've heard that before. You know? I got to do that at Comic-Con a bit.
Did you really?
Because Nana Visitor was there. She was cute, Major Kira in Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
She was, like, my hero for many years. So I got to kind of ask a question.
Yeah.
panel. I got to ask the last question.
Nice.
And it was a pretty good question. So I felt about that, but it was also just like, there's not really much you could say other than I loved your stuff. So, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't think...
Well, you can ask the question, hey, where do you get your ideas? That question that everybody loves so much.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I try not to ask the cliche questions. I can't avoid it. But,
yeah, we've never had an we've never interviewed somebody and had them talk about, you know, how they react to other indie developers early, so this is really interesting, seeing it from your eyes.
Yeah, it's nice going to GDC, because everyone's really laid back for the most part, and it's just like, oh, I like your stuff, and like, oh, I like your stuff, it's sweet, you know. You can actually talk in detail about the design and stuff, which is cool, and ends up being more of a productive conversation than just people, you know, saying nice things to each other. And everyone's kind of excited to find and discover work, which is neat. At least the people I hang out with, there isn't a lot of drama or stupid hierarchy, social pecking order stuff. It's more just like, oh, this looks really neat. Who made this? Oh, this guy made this. Oh, he's awesome. Whatever.
Yeah, it's actually been really cool as a new developer, like, coming in and talking to these people whose work I've, like, admired for so long, and have them just be totally cool and welcoming. Like, sometimes I'll talk to somebody and they'll be, like, asking me about my project and, like, the design choices. There's no air of pretension. And then I'll find out later, oh, like, you know, that was so-and-so. They made, like, this huge thing that I totally like. And then I'll freak out because it was just, there's no weird, you can't talk to this person thing for a lot of, which is so nice.
Yeah, and there's still that happens, but
there's always creepy stuff everywhere.
Yeah, a lot of indies are rather just, you know, they're outgoing and they're like, oh, okay, yeah, whatever. I love that, because, I mean, I'll contact one of them asking if they want to be an interview, and then I won't be like, who are you, what do you want, whatever, you know. They'll be like, oh, sure, when do you want to do an interview? Sure.
Yeah, it's pretty laid back for the most part. I think we're on the verge of that changing, unfortunately. I think as it becomes bigger and bigger, there's going to be more douchebags coming in and aren't really legit indie and trying to benefit the label and the exposure and stuff. And hopefully the community will survive that. So far, I think it's a little healthy, but yeah.
So I'm guessing you guys have had this asked 1,000 times, but how did you two get, meet up?
Twitter. Yeah.
Alec had been supporting Games Making Games randomly, which freaked me out, because this is like right after I had started it. It's like, holy shit, Alec Lucas like tweeting about us. Oh. And he was just like really supportive of the work and trying to get more than 5% of the industry to be women. And I think I got a little bit tipsy, so I wasn't too afraid to talk to him, and we just randomly started talking about stuff, and it just kind of went out from there.
It's a gradual thing, I guess.
Yeah.
Tweeting back and forth a bit.
Well, there's like the tweeting, and then I like got up the gumption to actually direct message you once, and I was like, whoa, oh my god, heavens. Is this weird? I hope it's not weird.
Yeah, it was adorably awkward, I guess.
Adorable.
Or sickeningly awkward, depending on your perspective.
Adorkable.
Adorkable.
And now we're working on a game together, which you had told me, like, last August that I'd be making a game with Alec Aloka. I'd be like, yeah, okay.
You should talk about this game.
Okay.
Yeah,
well,
sure.
It's their interview. Like, I don't want to just...
Oh, right.
I check it.
No, either of you guys can go.
Okay.
I was going to do, back when the Pirate Cart was doing a bunch of little games, like, there was a weekend we were all making games for the GDC one. I was going to do a short two-hour game about riffing on, like, the dating sim genre by doing an online dating game. Just have all the dates terrible, and I thought it was kind of a funny concept before the jam that I was like sort of playing the local version of. I had mentioned this to a few friends, and then everyone started telling me their awesome, horribly awkward dating stories. And I found that, like, it was just way too much fun to just rip on this concept, so I decided I wanted to actually develop into a full game, and I'm sort of working on that since, and I mentioned this to Alec, and I don't know if you want to... He just jumped in.
Yeah, I'd been on the site OKCupid before meeting Zoe, and so I'd gone through a breakup, and... I don't know, November, something like that. And so I was on the dating site, and it was kind of... I'm a person who hates being single. Like, I just don't... So I was talking to lots of different people, and having a lot of weird experiences. And so I was talking about her game called It's Not Okay, Keep It.
Yeah, I don't know if I've actually mentioned the project's name. And it was like a placeholder thing, so I made a joke about it. And it just sort of suck.
Yeah. And so basically the game is kind of about themes of isolation, which is oddly similar to Aquaria in some ways.
Yeah.
Even though it's an interactive fiction type game, it still has similar themes, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Because, I mean, it started out as just a comedy thing, but I wanted to take it further because I think with writing... I really like using it as a way to set the mood at sort of one point. So if you actually want to make any serious points, it's, like, that much more impactful later down the road. So it's, like, more or less, like you said, the bigger things for me are, like, isolation and how even though we, like, live in this era where we have the internet and, like, people like me and Alec can even meet in the first place, whereas, like, I'm originally from New York. If not for technology, we would never have met. So this age where we're supposed to be more connected than ever, sometimes it's just so much harder to actually make a real connection with somebody where you're really understanding each other. And all these layers of, like, self-imposed isolation that we put on ourselves through various reasons, a lot of the characters are exploring those.
Yeah, it's I got really excited about it when we started talking about it because actually we both trolled dating sites before.
Yeah, that's the thing too is we're both enormous trolls.
Yeah.
And you can actually play through the game like as much as of we're having it so that you know there's this one kind of meaning in there. We're also giving the players enough choice that if they want to just go around and be an enormous asshole, then you can totally do that.
Yeah. Somebody in the chat to pause the interview because they need to go do something.
Yeah, sure. We can definitely pause.
That's right. That's sweet, Shelby.
And he's like,
okay, thanks.
Oh, apparently it's not allowed.
How long are you?
30 seconds.
30 seconds.
Can we get like elevator music going or something?
Oh, it ended. Let's talk about some other subject for 30 seconds.
Like what?
Pizza rolls.
What's
wrong with pizza rolls? What about bacon-wrapped steak skewers?
That was pretty awesome.
Okay, now you guys are just making me hungry.
We had bacon-wrapped steak skewers and beer last night. It was pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah, we were at a party with a lot of old people. It was surprisingly awesome. I found out that a lot of the old people smoked pot.
That
used to be roadies.
So we guess who...
Shelby is getting irritated. He wants us to continue.
Okay.
Shelby, like, funds the podcast.
Well, Shelby, if you'd like us to continue, why don't you supply the next question or topic?
Yeah, smart guy.
Now we sit here in silence.
Okay.
All right. We're hanging on your every word.
Oh, my God.
That Shelby.
This is so exciting.
I'm so excited.
No pressure, Shelby, but this question better be good.
We're going to be judging you very harshly on this.
Yeah. Why did I rage quit at Aquaria?
You spelled Aquaria
wrong. No, that's not that Shelby, so
I know, yeah,
we can't answer that.
We can't answer that one.
You spelled Aquaria wrong. Get out.
Oh, that's a good question.
Oh, that is a good
question. Okay, I'll go first, and then you can...
Well, he's asking you.
Well, the question is, what advice would you give to someone who would like to go into development all the time?
Just yeah, advice we give.
The listeners can't quite read.
Basically, go to a bunch of game jams and prototype stuff as much as you can. And typically what happens with a lot of people, and what happened with me, is that... I started trying to recreate Final Fantasy VI using Cube, and I worked on that for, I don't know how many years, and I just keep throwing it out and restarting it, because I wanted to make an entire RPG by myself, just crazy. And so it was a really good learning experience, but I never actually got anything done or released. I'd post about some stuff. There was a huge Q-Basic RPG community back in the old days. and I would post screenshots like, yeah, we're playing this game. I really want to get it done. Hey, and then, you know, a month later, this isn't enough to throw it out, rewrite the engine from scratch. And that was the part that was a good learning experience. I got really good at building engines for making RPGs. just by redoing, you know, over and over. But what would probably be better is building smaller projects and actually finishing them and then going through the whole process of releasing something and having people hate it, which inevitably happens, and having people get mad at you and realizing how you can deal with that, because it's difficult to do that, especially if you're making something you really care about that's really personal to you. Like, if somebody insults your game, it almost feels like they're insulting you personally just because of how close you are to it. So you kind of have to learn how to have a healthy distance while still caring and still be able to read all the feedback and take good things out of it. Useful things that you can use to get better at development.
Hey, Alec, I'm sorry for interrupting, but the call's kind of cutting out, so I'm going to call you back in a sec.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. All right, so right now, I'm calling Alec back. The internet connection was getting really rough. And he's back, I believe.
Okay, are we good?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, and just continuing on that a little bit, another really good thing to do is find a community of other indie game developers who can help you out. And, like, we have that now. There's actually, like, a Skype chat with 80 other indie game developers that we're on. There are IRC chat rooms, Twitter, there's tons of places, Tutors forums, if you stick to the creative part, they're still pretty good for finding people like that, and it's super helpful. I mean, it's helpful in a number of ways. It's helpful because you get, like, free mentorship. People will pass on information and help you out when you have problems, but also it's just cool to have friends who are game developers, and, you know, if you're ever feeling kind of crappy, you can talk to them about that, and that's really helpful, too.
I'd say take that farther and actually see if you can find a local game community. And if you don't have one,
start it.
Yeah, because that's what helped me the most when I started really diving into development, was meeting other awesome indies locally that I could, like, even just playtesting their game, I learned so much about design and level design and testing and all these really important things, and just seeing why people made choices was really helpful. Also, it keeps you from getting into this place where you're working really hard on something you care really strongly about, and you end up not seeing the forest for the trees, or you end up feeling really, really lonely. And making sure you can take care of yourself emotionally while doing something creative full-time is really important, because you can't really do much if you're just wallowing in your own depression to the point where you can't actually create. Like, it's one thing to be depressed and still on the like, of the scale that you're still making stuff, but it can get pretty bad and feel really isolated, and that's, like, one of the downsides to working from home. You just get in your own little world, and someone there to pull you out of it.
Also someone to give you critical feedback.
Yes.
Be like, oh, by the way, your game sucks.
Yeah, that is so key. And, like, honestly, I would say, like, if you want to do the full-time indie thing, be willing to not work on something if it sucks. Like, if you're, like, don't try and go down with, like, a specific ship. Like, by all means, try things. Make little prototypes all the time. I'm trying to do it more for myself, honestly. But when something's not working and it's not, there's nothing there, be willing to make the hard decision and go work on something else, or completely scrap it and start over.
Yeah, but that's kind of like the best skill I think you can learn, is being able to say, I don't know, if you really don't know what the right answer to something is. I remember as a kid, it was really hard for me to do that, but as an adult, it's become a lot easier because I realize I don't know a lot of stuff. But I remember hanging out on the game dev forums as a kid, and it was a lot of posturing, a lot of sort of programmer kids wanting to sort of say, oh, I'm making the best engine. And it was all about engine development and not about actually making games. And people were like, yeah, I'm going to make this awesome like MMORPG. I just have to make this engine first, you know, and then they just get obsessed with their engine and they never make anything. You know, and people were like, oh, mine's better because I used this technique. And it's like, oh, I use this technique. And it's just like, stuff like that is such a waste of time. If you actually want to make games and finish them and get them out, it doesn't matter what tool you use. It doesn't matter if you use it in a proper way or not. It just matters, like, what the end result is and whether people actually like it, you know. And getting to that point now is super easy. You can use Unity, you can use Stencil, use Flixel, Flashpunk, Game Maker. There's all these tools, and you can skip past the stupid programming phase and get to the part where you have a game. And then the best thing to do is be really open to changing your mind about, you know, what you think makes a good game. Like, if you haven't made a game before, you probably don't have a very good idea about what makes a good game. And you're going to have to learn that the hard way by releasing stuff and having people hate it. And, you know, the faster you can, like, learn that and be open to learning that and let go of your ego and stuff, the better it'll be.
Yeah, and definitely be okay with the fact that you're, like, the best mentor I ever had for anything where you were making, like, in any field where you're creating something is, like, it was specifically photography, and he told me, you have 10,000 crappy photos in you, just get them out as soon as possible, just, like, just keep making, and be willing to forgive yourself for not making something good, and just use it as a learning experience and see what worked, what didn't, and try to pay that forward into whatever you work on next. And don't really care so much just don't get too down on yourself.
Yeah.
And don't be afraid of trying things because you're afraid of making something that's not that great.
Yeah, and you can take a break from your big passion project to prototype something on a weekend.
Yeah.
And if you really like working on that better, you should probably drop the big passion project, at least for the time being. And that Shelby just mentioned in the chat, he said, same with graphic sounds, he's referring to when I was talking about working on game engines instead of working on an actual game. He says you can play a game with rectangles, but you can't play a folder full of PSDs.
Yeah.
So that's a good point. And it's difficult, too, because a lot of games that I work on, the graphics are really important to them, and the audio is also really important. And it's like, for me, it's about how all those things work together. So I like to develop the art at the same time as everything else, but that often ends up in time wasted, kind of. Because it's like, oh, we found this time making this really cool art, but it was made for this specific gameplay, and that gameplay didn't really pan out, so now we got to throw out a bunch of the art and redo it. But at the same time, it's hard to tell if gameplay is working if you don't have at least some reasonable placeholder art that gives you a sense of how the character is going to look when they're moving. Mm-hmm. Because if you do just have a box moving around, it doesn't always, like, say you had a game where a character is jumping, you don't always get the sense of momentum that you'd have if you actually saw the movement of their body, and especially for games where you have something like swinging, seeing the character actually swing their legs forward and back as they swing makes a huge difference in how the game feels, even though it's actually playing technically exactly the same way. So, yeah. There's definitely, like, games are kind of like an illusion. The underlying mechanics are often not that exciting. And even when they are exciting, the way that you dress them up changes the way people look at them and feel about them. So I think art is important, is more important than some designers think it is, but of course it's also not
as important as
some triple A companies think.
Yeah.
But,
So, each of you guys can answer this, but what's your favorite programming tool or library, etc.?
For me, it's definitely Unity now, after, I don't know how long I've been using it, but for Aquaria, I wrote my own engine in C++, which was something I was working on for about a year before we actually started working on the game, just on the side, doing a bunch of sort of tests and things with it. And I was like, when I met Derek, and we started talking about Aquaria, I was like, well, I have this engine, we could just use that. from there, it was a process of developing it fully and stuff, which takes so much time. And with C++, there's so many weird bugs that can happen, like weird memory leaks, and because of the way that the language is designed, it's prone to that. And you have to really be on your toes the whole time. It's very stressful. And I've always kind of been someone who thinks about things visually, especially code. So for me, Unity is perfect because it's a mixture of code and using a UI and building things in 3D space and being able to go really quickly between editing code, playing the game, tweaking values in the editor. Like whenever you make a new variable, it becomes a GUI element that you can tweak. So you can develop really, really quickly with it.
To answer a question in the chat, I am learning Unity now. Originally, my first game thing was Stencil, and I didn't like it because I like doing things that have like a lot of interactive elements that have words in them, and it didn't seem to want to behave with that. Then I moved on to Flash. Now I'm learning Unity. Using Playmaker.
Funny story about Playmaker.
Yeah.
When we started working on It's Not Okay Cupid, basically it's a lot of branching dialogue trees. And I was kind of like, oh cool, I can write like a system for branching dialogue, which would be really fun to write and design, and then Zoe can use it to create all this content. So in Unity you can actually create editor scripts and make your own editing tool, basically. So I did that. And we had it working and stuff, and I had this whole node editing system for making conversations. You could connect the nodes, make different types of nodes. They had color coding stuff. It looked pretty cool, and it was fairly usable. And then I discovered Playmaker. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I realized I bought it, I started playing around with it a bit, and I was like, yeah, I could just make the whole conversation system using Playmaker, and it would take me, it ended up taking me, I think, like one night to get the main conversation system working in Playmaker.
It wasn't even a full night either.
Yeah.
It started pretty late, and it was like a few hours earlier, like, oh, by the way, I completely changed the engine.
So compared to like 2 weeks of writing a conversation system from scratch that wasn't fully fleshed out, versus like just using Playmaker and taking like a day to get most of it working again, and Playmaker has features that are nicer than the conversation editor, like the way the node editing is a lot nicer and stuff like that.
And beyond that, like it was just a lot more powerful and gives me a lot of flexibility to design like weird stuff that goes on in dialogue and things that will happen, like be able to make cool callbacks in global variables in interactions with other people that happen with like in a very specific way, and that's really cool because, especially for something like It's Not Okay Cupid, where I want it to feel fairly unique and organic, because it bothers me with anything like RPG or adventure-based or anything where you can interact with people in a game, to not have that feel natural, like to basically be like, oh, well, your sister's a terrible person at one guy, and like two questions later, they don't even remember that you said that. It really gives me a lot of freedom to be able to avoid situations like that.
To tie that into the questions in the chat, the way it works is you have different blocks. They're basically called states. So essentially what you get out of Playmaker is finite state machines. And if you don't know what finite state machines are, you should look them up because they're super useful for programming all kinds of things, especially AI, simple game AI. It basically just means that like you have something that can only be in one state at a time. So if you had a player, the player could either be running or jumping or sitting or crouching, but not a combination of those. And the advantage of that is it makes it really easy to organize your code around that. So the way that Playmaker works, you're building these state machines. So just make a new state called running and a new state called jumping, and then you can connect them using transitions and events, and you can define what those transitions and events are. And you can pretty much, with Playmaker, you don't have to touch code if you don't want to, if you're doing basic stuff, because it comes with a bunch of actions. And you can put actions onto these states. So when you hit a certain state, like jumping, you might add an action, like play an animation. So when you hit the jumping state, play the jumping animation. And you can do stuff like, oh, when the animation is done, or when you hit the ground, when an event occurs, or when somebody pushes a button, for example. So say you're in like a default idle state, and you were waiting for someone to push space, and that would move you to the jumping state, that would play a jump animation, and add some upward force. All that stuff you can do without having to touch code. But the really cool thing about Playmaker is you can extend it if you know C# or JavaScript. I think you might have to use C# to extend it. I'm not sure. But you can write your own actions, basically, and then add them in using the GUI. So it's really cool, especially if you're collaborating with people who don't know how to code, or if you're an artist and you're collaborating with a programmer who can write new actions for you. Basically, it works really well that way because the programmer can create custom actions, but then the designer or artist who doesn't understand the code can just use the UI part of it to add those actions to things and manipulate them.
Or even if they do understand the code, you can just be like, hey, I would rather spend my time focusing on...
Yeah.
Because like going into this together when we were talking about it, because I was just trying to do this solo on my own in a visual novel engine called Renpy, which is nowhere near as powerful as what we're doing now. Looking at trying to organize something as complicated as huge branching dialogue trees and game with little responses to everything, and it just seemed like that in pure code was going to be a nightmare, and having some way to visually organize that makes it way faster for me to do things like develop, you know, really specific dialogue trees and reactions to them.
Yeah, it's I really like it so far. I'm not sure about using it for other types of games yet. I haven't experimented with that so much. But I know from the Playmaker website it's been used in game jams for games that have, you know, a third person 3D with characters running around, performing different states and stuff like that. So yeah. And one of the things, like, what's coming up in the chat right now, people are sort of talking about how they're bad at coding. And the funny thing is some of the best indie game developers I know think that they're bad at coding. And they kind of are from the standpoint of traditional university-style programming, but in terms of game programming, they're really good at it. Because, and one example is Adam Saltzman, the developer of Cannibalt. Mm-hmm. He thinks that he's like not like a programmer. But, I mean, he wrote his own game engine called Flixel. I mean, like, so maybe he's just being hard on himself. But I know he tends to take a lot of really clever shortcuts that some programmers would maybe frown on, but in terms of game programming, that's what it's all about. It's not about, like, oh, am I building this system to, like, the greatest standards? It's more like, oh, am I building a system that actually makes a fun game and runs well enough? Like, if you hit those two things, you're kind of fine. And with the tools we have now, it's more almost like game scripting. It's not so much, like, hardcore programming.
You don't have to write
like a rendering engine.
Yeah.
And so the rendering engine stuff is where it really helps to have an understanding of, say, Big O notation. And if you want to have a fun afternoon, you can look up Big O notation. It's a way of measuring how efficient your code is. And it helps to understand that stuff, but it's also sort of common sense to some degree. Once you start sort of playing around with code and understanding how it works. So I'm kind of in the same boat. I don't think I'm a terribly great programmer or anything, but I know enough code to get by in terms of developing games, and that's kind of all I really need to know. That said, it's always cool to learn more. It's always cool to keep learning and trying to understand your work better.
How about indies that have said that they're good programmers? Do you know any?
I don't know what Tommy Refnes thinks about himself, but he is, like, an amazing coder. Like, he's the programmer from Super Meat Boy.
Mm-hmm.
And he, the amount of multi-threading going on in the Super Meat Boy engine is incredible. Like, I think the controls are on the wrong thread.
Oh, wow.
And the reason for that is just so it's like, so we could get the most responsive version of the game possible. And I'm just like, dude, that's insane. Like, I can't even, like, multi-threading programming breaks my brain. I had to write a little bit of multi-threading code for Aquaria at one point. We were testing out different audio engines, and I was running an OpenAL / OggVorbis decoder thing, so it would have to stream Ogg files off of your computer on a separate thread, so the game, when the game halted to load assets, the music would keep playing.
Oh, yeah.
And eventually, we just ended up buying FMod, because it does that automatically for you. But I had it working, but it would crash randomly.
Yeah,
it's like, I don't know where it's crashing, I can't figure it out.
I was seeing you look at, one of the other projects I'm on right now is a game called Super Street Fire, which isn't a video game. It's basically, we've built these this ring of flamethrowers, like literal flamethrowers. This is not like, you know, video game flamethrowers. You actually stand in a ring of flamethrowers. And we built these data capturing gloves where you do motions and send them at your opponent, and the ring reacts. And trying to look at the multi-threading stuff that they've got going on for there just completely melted my brain. It's so crazy.
I think there's going to be, well, newer languages that are coming out handle threads a lot better than C++.
Yeah.
So, for example, Go, which is Google's language,
mm-hmm.
is way more about concurrent programming and running things at the same time and making that easy to do. So I think in the future it'll get a bit easier, because we have so many multi-core machines, like in consoles and stuff, that there's definitely demand for a language that can handle that stuff without having to go insane. So I imagine in the future there'll be nice visual tools where you can actually see the threads, and like, yeah. And there are debug tools that let you see threads, but visual tools that let you construct threads would be really cool. Like if Unity had concurrent stuff, that'd be really cool. Like, even if you have multiple objects and they're running scripts, they're not really running at the same time. They take turns.
Mm-hmm.
They go one by one, basically. But it'd be really cool if you could get to the point where they are running concurrently. You can actually just see, like, maybe with Playmaker, see these different state machines firing off at the same time.
That would look so cool.
Yeah.
How are you two doing on time? Do we need to wrap up or anything?
We have a bit of time, I think.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I remember you saying something about how you had something to go to tonight.
Yeah, I'm doing a dinner theater thing, which is really hard to explain. And but yeah, basically I'm playing music for an amateur dinner theater production. Brain Builder? I haven't heard of Brain Builder.
Me neither.
It's brought, but I'll try to Google it. Our internet's kind of sluggish today. Sometimes Google doesn't load.
Don't make me do the thing again, because I don't want to have to work to move over the thousands of places to a third thing. Damn it.
Yeah, no, I don't even know if it's a Unity thing.
No, you said it's a Unity thing. It looks easier than Playmaker.
I
hate their website.
No, I'm on a different site. I'm pretty sure it's not it.
Well, then add Unity.
Oh, there we go. Yeah. Hmm. Yeah.
I don't know that that's good for the branching, because the nice thing about Playmaker for specifically doing a game with branching dialogue is the way that it keeps track of the branches.
Yeah, and this, from what I can see so far, doesn't seem to be as fleshed out.
Yeah.
I mean, just looking at the forum post, it has a lot less information on it than Playmaker does. Playmaker has links to, like, tons of stuff, so I kind of, right off the bat, don't get... And the other thing is, Playmaker is, like, number one or two on the asset store right now, which is also a really good sign. Yeah. The two things we're using. NGUI.
Oh, really?
We're using NGUI, which is a GUI-making tool, because Unity's GUI stuff isn't really that great for doing actual, like, game UI that looks nice. And NGUI is something that you can scan really easily, and it scales up with the 3D properly and everything. But yeah, number one is anime, number two is Playmaker. Number three is Rage Spline, which is also really good. It's a really cool vector art creating tool that you actually use inside Unity and draw stuff and make shapes and change the splines and stuff like that.
That sounds pretty cool.
But you can also make the object solid, so you can just draw levels pretty much Yeah, like doing these shapes and...
That sounds awesome.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. X2D is now beating 2D Toolkit.
Huh.
So, mm-hmm. I have 2D Toolkit. I have not used EX2D or whatever, so... Yeah, oh yeah, Playmaker is number one for you? Okay. I think it's number one in its category. Whatever its category is. I guess the visual scripting category. And number two is UScript. I have not played around with UScript, so I don't know much about it. But yeah, it looks a bit more complicated.
It looks kind of like the old system.
Not sure if that's like... Well, it looks like they've separated things out into different types of things.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Playmaker is all finite state machines. This looks like more like there are maybe the events are drawn differently or something. I'm not sure. I'm just looking at screenshots. So.
So I'm going to move on to the question.
I've heard it's a lot like the UDK visual scripting thing, but I don't, you know. I don't use UDK, so I can't speak to that.
So I'm guessing everyone is wanting to know the answer to this question, so I'm going to bring it up. What do you have to do to become famous in the indie gaming world? What is the one, you know, like, just magic tip?
There's magic? Is that how you did it?
Yeah.
You sorcerer.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I don't even know.
That was more of a joke question.
I don't think I'm famous in that sense, but I think it's a combination, I think, of being really good at what you're doing, which maybe sounds pretentious to say, but part of that, like, most of that is just hard work. Like, it's not just having, like, quote-unquote talent. It's developing talent. So, like, if you really want to make games and you really want to be good at it, you really have to go for it. You have to focus on it. And I see a lot of people who are like, oh, indie games are cool. I want to make an indie game. And then meanwhile, they're also trying to start a band and they're trying to write a novel and they're in school and they're, you know, they're doing all these things. And it's like, well, if you really, really, really want to do this, you have to stop all that other stuff and focus on it. You know, unless you're going to just collaborate with other people or something. But if you're trying to make it on your own, for the most part, you have to drop that other stuff and you have to basically make games all day.
Beyond that,
actually do it.
Yeah, like, well, I don't know if trying to become famous with indie games is even a good
idea. Yeah, that'd be a bad way to go about it. Unless,
yeah, you'd probably annoy the crap out of everybody else.
Probably annoy people. And I remember I've seen some developers that just kind of are attention whores, and it kind of works for them. Like, they're at least, like, they sort of go so over the top with their attention whoring that that's how they get their fans.
But it's kind of amusing in a way.
It's kind of amusing. Like,
do you really want to be that guy, or do you want to be the guy that just makes really good games and cares about them?
Like, yeah, do you want to be known for your attitude, or do you want to be known for your games? And that goes both ways on the attitude thing. Like, you could be known for having a really crappy attitude, but you could be known for having a really good attitude and helping people out and starting communities and doing all that kind of stuff, which that actually helps too, oddly enough. Like, it helps to be someone who's, I think, seen as a positive influence on the community, because whenever you want to collaborate with someone, you have a way better chance at it if people know you as, oh, this person is generally good-natured and they like helping people out.
Yeah, that's who you
versus someone who's like, oh, they're mad at people all the time and jealous and acting out and being dramatic and stuff. It's like, you probably will still find people to collaborate with. So I don't really want to like say that that's the wrong way to go, because maybe for some people it's totally the right way to go. Just be like a huge dick and that's their
shtick. I'm saying it's a crappy motivation.
Yeah, it seems like it.
I don't know.
There are some people who seem to be doing it almost like a joke, and it's kind of cool in a way.
I don't know. I just feel like we might get more of that, though, because it's sort of what happened with games journalism forever ago, is that, like, a couple people came in, and that was their shtick, and now it's, like, games journalism is full of a bunch of people who are like, oh, well, that works, so I'm just going to be angry and mean everything, and act like a freaking prima donna. And,
yeah, that would be kind of silly.
Yeah, so I wouldn't encourage anybody to do that. I would encourage to just make the stuff that you love, and be open about the fact that you love it.
Yeah, Phil came up in the chat, Phil Fish, and he's an interesting guy, but he's multifaceted. Like, when you hang out with him in person, he's generally pretty chilled out and just kind of like a dude who wants to make his games, and then sometimes he kind of flies off the handle. in public, and sometimes it's just sort of for show, and sometimes he's really actually pissed off, and it's very complicated. It's not.
Yeah.
You can't really simplify him too much, I think.
You can't simplify anything like that. He's not like this weird cartoon character that a lot of people...
Yeah, a lot of people kind of treat him like a stereotype of a person because of just things that they've heard about him and aren't even true sometimes.
And it's like bandwagoning, right? It's like, yeah. Oh, hey, we're all going to be like we're going to do this because...
I mean, that's kind of one of the reasons why you don't really want to be famous, because that's what happens. You know, like, mm-hmm. people basically turn you into a cartoon character.
Yeah, you don't really get to be a person anymore. You're this concept.
So I'm pretty sure I'm not that well known because it hasn't happened to me, and I don't think I'm generally that way where I would be characterized as one thing or another because I'm just not that distinct in terms of... But like, it's like Phil, like, you know he's going to get mad and yell about something eventually, and then so he gets characterized that way, and that's not all that he's about, but it is something that he does sometimes, and so people slap that label on him, and now he's known as the angry game developer in some circles.
But for example, like, my experience with him is that he randomly, like, when I was looking for research for It's Not Okay Cupid, and I was looking for dating stories, he just randomly, like, contributed, and, like, there's no weirdness. He was just really cool about it, and he's been nothing but nice to me, so it's, like, weird for me, because I haven't ever really experienced anything but, like, the dude just being nice to me.
Mm-hmm. There's some talk in the chat about starting something like Indie Buskers, but done by people who are just starting out. And I think that's cool. It'd be cool to do something, like, maybe even just... It'd be a cool event to have, like, make your first game. And it's kind of like Glorious Trainwrecks, I guess.
Well, that's what January was.
Yeah, and having an online event where it's like, oh, like, here's the time when a bunch of people make their first games. And just encouraging people to jump in and do that would be really neat, I think.
Yeah, I ran something like that for Dance Making Games in January, where we took 10 of small teams or individual women who had never made a game before in their life, and specifically, like, for the when I opened applications, I looked for people with the least amount of experience. And by the end of that month, they all created their first prototype. And we had, like, weekly lessons and then work sessions where people would come in and work on their stuff and get feedback from... We got some pretty good mentors to help out, like Miguel Sternberg, who's half of Spooky Squid Games, who's going to be releasing Beyblade Pixels soon, which is going to be awesome. And I highly recommend that you guys check it out.
What's it called again? Just cause
it's called They Bleed Pixels. It's yeah, it's like a platforming beat-em-up that is... The way it does combat is pretty good and punishes button mashing and rewards style. The platforming is pretty intense and the level design's all really good. I highly recommend it. But yeah, he was one of our mentors and would just come in and work with some of the newbies. And at the end, everybody had their first game. Everybody's still making games. And it was just such a positive, awesome thing. So seeing more stuff like that takes total first-time people and ideally has some mentors on hand, because the mentorship did a lot for community building, especially if you're stressing the hard work and not that, like, rewarding hard work instead of rewarding having, like, the best game ever at the end, because nobody's going to make the best game ever on their first try or anything like that. It would be really cool to see more stuff like that, because it was just such an awesome thing to be involved with.
Bam.
So, that was held in January, you said?
I don't ever do nonprofit stuff without making a horrible pun about it, so it was Jamuary.
Oh, I gotcha.
Somebody's asking me. Okay, so a question that came up in IRC was, what was the biggest obstacle starting Dames Making Games? Well, starting it was easy. Starting it was basically seeing that there were women who wanted to do it, and then just making the decision to do it, and then start figuring out what to do with that from there. So actually starting it was pretty easy. I basically saw that there was a lot of women who had an interest with this stuff, and after coming out of a similar thing myself, and then I threw together basically a pub night, where I'm just like, hey, just come out, we'll all drink and talk about games and stuff like that. And that was awesome. And the first one, there was probably 6 to 10 women that showed up. And then the next one, we had problems, like the next monthly pub night, I actually had to start looking into other venues for it because we just had sort of overtook the wait staff. So that was a great problem to have. And from there, it just sort of grew and grew because we were very specific about our charter. And, you know, we don't exclude men from events. We ask that they bring a woman who's either into game development, curious about game development, or, like, any aspect of the game industry, too. So, like, PR people or, you know, people who are strictly artists or just everybody that has an interest is welcome, which I guess that was probably the biggest obstacle, is to find out how to talk about these things in a way that nobody feels excluded or attacked. Because Dames Making Games is about, we want to provide a positive environment. And trying to do that with a topic that can be as charged as women in games gets was probably one of the bigger challenges. Everything else is, the game community has been very supportive of us, which is really nice. And I mean, there's always like people that are going to be jerks about it, but yeah.
I'm not sure if you already answered this.
Sorry.
But how exactly did you go about finding people for your program?
Oh, well, I just started talking to people a lot, I think. Like, I got a few speaking things, like, geared towards just having anybody, like, encouraging people to make their own games and why they should and why, like, what the medium is. And, you know, trying to do that at places like, I did a talk called You Can Make Games at Southern Ontario Con, or SoonCon, where it's just a hacker makerspace. And then I would just talk to people. That one-on-one interaction was very helpful, especially because it would be, like, a woman going to another woman, and there's like, that seemed to be really helpful. We also had, I would get a lot of support from our male allies who would be like, oh man, I totally know this girl who'd be great, you should talk to her. And then they'd introduce me, and I'd get really excited about game development, and they'd usually come out and the talk I did at Toronto Independent Film Festival seemed to pull in a bunch of girls too, which was good. And talking to educators as well to try to get women who are like in high school and that age range, because like it's better to get started earlier with tech, and it's not something women are usually that encouraged to go into, has been really cool too, and a good source of finding, you know, girls that are interested in things like that. And word of mouth has been great. Just basically throwing my heart at it has been how it's happened, I think. I don't really know. I just get really excited, and for some reason, people listen to me.
Right. In the chat, they're talking about what programming language would be smartest to learn. And there's Alec commented in there saying that C# is pretty sweet. And then Hedgemedge said to try Python and then Mono. So.
Yeah, Mono is basically C# for cross-platform stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And Unity actually uses Mono. That's how it compiles C# and JavaScript and Boo. There's a language in there called Boo, which is like Python or
That's
something.
That's adorable.
Yeah. But nobody uses it. Pretty much most people use C# through Unity now.
Mm-hmm.
When they're using Unity, they use C# rather. And Mono handles all the crazy cross compilation stuff.
So,
and I have a friend, who is Matt Thorson. he's working on a new game engine in C#, and right now it's just XNA, but it will support Mono game and be cross platform at some point. So it's really fun to use his engine to build stuff. It's like Flash Punk on steroids.
Oh.
And C# has a lot of really nice language features that let you do stuff really easily, which is cool. So,
you said this is Matt Thorson, right?
Yeah, hopefully. I'm not sure when he's going to go public with that. But
he's going to be okay with you talking about it on here, right?
Oh, say what?
He's going to be okay with you talking about it on here, though.
I hope so. Yeah, it's Matt. He's pretty chill about everything except people hitting on his ex-girlfriends. That's his only thing he gets upset about.
Oh.
Other than that...
Let me grab my notebook quick.
He's just probably like, yeah, whatever. I don't see why not.
Oh, God!
Selch just asks, is it true that Microsoft dropped XNA? I haven't heard anything about that.
I don't know what I don't think that was the case.
It doesn't sound right at all.
No.
As far as I know, it's still used for XBLA games and
stuff. A lot of XBLA developers are going to be really upset.
Maybe they just meant he drops it like...
Like pot?
Yeah.
Oh.
Drop it like it's XNA. Drop it like it's XNA.
No, it's not really.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's almost 2 o'clock here. The radio's been on for about an hour and a half. So if somebody wants to ask a last question, you can type it in the chat and we'll get it answered. And we sit here in silence.
I'm getting word from Noel. That Noel thinks Matt's engine is already public, but I'm not sure if it really is, though. So, if he gets back to me...
Yeah, Noel's...
Oh, okay. Alright, so I can actually share this engine that's... Here.
Alright. Is it on the...
Yeah.
So, Bitbucket...
So, it's actually a new version of the Monocle engine.
Cool. For people listening in, we'll have the link either on the page. Well, I mean, people who are listening to this after it's broadcasted, we'll have the link on the page. And if you're too lazy to go there, even though you're already there, it is bitbucket.org/MattThorson/monocle engine.
Monocle engine, yeah. MONOCLE engine.
And, Bitbucket seems a lot like any other Git engine stuff, like GitHub or whatnot. So. Alright. So, anybody get a question out there? No. Okay. We should sit here.
Any question at all?
Going once, going twice.
Go for it. That Shelby, you've been so good to us so far.
He said, I can make one up if that makes you guys feel better. So Shelby is going to create a question.
That Shelby.
No, Alec, that one.
Oh. You are so good at questions!
What is your favorite part of making games?
What is your favorite part? It's really a hard question to answer, actually.
My favorite part is all of it.
Yeah.
Or at least in the sense that I get to... Like, my life right now is I wake up in the morning, I blitz on a game that I care about very passionately... And then I pass out from exhaustion. That's my favorite part of games, is just being able to make something that intensely and have it be, like, something that I, like, just being able to do it full-time, I guess, is my favorite part.
Yeah, and my favorite part about it is how many different parts there are. So there's, like, all these different elements that come together. You know, you get to do music, you get to do art, you get to do code, you get to do design, you get to hang out with really awesome people.
Yeah.
So, like, that's kind of why I love it so much. It's really, like, all of it works. And if there was one part that really, really sucked, I might not love it as much, but I don't think there are any parts that really suck.
It sucks when you get a bit depressed about it.
Almost like a tangential thing. Yeah. It's more about the project. Like, that's more about picking the right project. And once you have a good one, you're set. Like, that stuff doesn't come up very much.
Right.
But if you're working on a crappy project or with the wrong people or something, yeah, it can get really bad.
I also like how all of those things, like, mix together in such a big way if you if you want them to. Like, that's the thing that I think when I made my first game, I'm like, yes, this is the thing I want to do for the rest of my life, because I was flitting around between a bunch of mediums, and I'd always liked mixing them, because I'd been doing, like, 2D art. I could program a bit, music, and I'm like, how can I get all of these things to go together? Well, I can't figure it out. I'm going to go play video games while I think about it. Wait a minute. So having all those things come together is just really cool.
Yeah, when they don't come together, it sucks.
Yeah.
And sometimes it does happen. But when it works, it's a really beautiful thing.
Yeah.
There you have it, folks.
One last little comment. Question, whatever. What do you guys use for audio music production stuff?
Oh, okay. For Aquaria, I used Fruity Loops.
Did you really?
Yeah, people are always like, what? Fruity Loops? And I'm like, yep. And I even use some of the stock, like, loops. And people are like, what? I'm like, yeah, they're fine. You dress them up.
Yeah, I guess. Jesus. I'm spoiled that I used Ableton.
Nice.
I don't know what that is.
Oh, you might like it. It's pretty sweet. We were actually, I was trying to do this two-person band thing that we were trying to make interactive concerts. Yeah, messing around with Arduinos and Ableton, because the two of them are actually surprisingly easy to get to cooperate with each other. But yeah, like, Ableton is freaking fantastic if you get a chance to try it out. It's like, it's such a fun interface to work into. It's almost like playing a game while you're making it.
I'd recommend Reason if you're doing serious composition stuff. I'm using Reason now, and I really like it. It's, like, incredibly powerful. It's what Danny B uses. Pretty sure it's what Rich used for Fez as well. But yeah, it's just a really great tracker with a bunch of really cool stock instruments that you can completely customize. Like, they're all made out of synth patches and stuff, and the amount of control you have over it is kind of overwhelming. But you can make, like, the Offspring Fling soundtrack was made in Reason, and I didn't even know how to use it. Like, I was just picking default instruments and tweaking stuff a little bit, but I wasn't really fully customizing things, and I could still make a pretty solid soundtrack. So once you get into the really crazy stuff, I'm sure you can go nuts and make completely unique sounding instruments and all that stuff. Question about atmosphere. The question is, atmosphere is an important part of most games. What are some tips to get things feeling atmospheric? It's a really hard question to answer, too, because, I really like atmosphere in games. It's kind of one of the reasons that I'll play games, and one of the things I like about games. The games that I really like have a really cool atmosphere, a moody atmosphere, and to me, sometimes that trumps gameplay. It's like, I don't really care if I'm shooting people in the face over and over again if the atmosphere is cool.
It's just how I exist in it, right?
Yeah, and part of it is the pacing, and that's a really touchy thing, because pacing in games is an interesting subject. Like, pacing in a movie is just, the movie goes at whatever pace it was directed at, and people can either watch it or not. In a game, it's like, well, are you going to force the player to go slowly? Or are you going to let them go as fast as they want? Are you going to make it play out differently depending on how they play? Are you going to is the game going to adapt the pace of the player? Or is it going to force the pacing? So Aquaria starts off really slow-paced, which I really like. It gets more intense as it goes on, but some players really had a hard time with the slow pace at the beginning, and they would just, like, I don't know what I'm doing, I quit in the first, half an hour or something. It's kind of like, oh, okay. So it's a hard thing to do, I think.
The games that have pulled off atmosphere pretty well to me, it seems to be the interplay of all those different factors that we had mentioned before, like how the game feels to play, if the music and the art do a good job of working together to set something that feels like really cohesive. Because, like, if something takes me out of, being immersed in the atmosphere, then that's like the biggest thing that breaks it for me. So I guess keeping just cohesive design and not breaking immersion for me would probably be the two things that I think really suck me into a game.
Yeah, that's the thing that annoys me a lot about AAA games, because they're trying to appeal to such a wide audience. They tend to put in screens and things interrupting the game to tell you what to do in a way that doesn't fit into the game's universe.
Yeah.
And it just sucks me out of the experience. It's like, I was getting into that, and then you put up this stupid screen or, you know, whatever. They have some really ugly UI that just floats there. And
minigames.
or, you know, yeah, QuickTime events or whatever. And it's like, blah.
yeah.
Alright. Are you still there?
No.
Oh, shoot. Got really quiet. I thought the call had cut out. Alright. Well, thanks, Alec and Zoe, for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having us on.
Yeah, thanks.
I hope your guys' dinner music thing goes alright.
yeah. I think it'll be good.
I think it'll be good.
Alright. And hope to see some awesome games coming.
All right, cool.
Well, if you want to follow our game development... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, probably the best way is Twitter.
Twitter is probably the best way. I do regular dev blog posts about... it's not OKCupid on www.beesgo.biz. So I'm posting, like, probably weekly-ish dev blogs there if you want to check the development there, because we're really going to be blitzing out a bunch of stuff for that in the coming weeks.
So would you like me to link your Twitters to your names on our website then?
Sure. Yeah, I just posted them in the chat. So
we also used hashtag it's not okay Cupid. Okay is spelled out like O K A Y.
All right. Cool. Well, chat with you later, I guess. And thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
Anytime. Bye.
All right. Next up, we have our credits. Thank you for listening to broadcast number 26 of Indie Radio. This broadcast was broadcasted live with 1,000 mics and was recorded using Audacity. All music was found on Newgrounds coming from Nemesis 3 and 3 Clicks Philip. Thank you again for listening in, and we hope to have you be a part of the next broadcast, which will be May 12th. Have a good weekend.